You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Wisconsin's 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline launched about 6 months ago. The state's Crisis Services Coordinator tells us how it's been going so far. Now, how often do you think about the longevity of things you create? A lot of the stuff we might make with our hands probably have some sort of shelf life. But our next guest creates with copper, and his works of art are meant to stand the test of time. Mark Fisher is a contemporary sculptor and member of the Oneida Nation of Green Bay Turtle Clan. He's recently completed a couple of public installations, including a depiction of indigenous culture near Stevens Point at Lake Emily Park. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
What got you into working with copper as a medium for sculpture, Mark?
It was just antibacterial, antiviral. It's safe for all occasions, and it just seemed like the right element to work with.
One of the things I love about copper, at least sometimes, is how it ages and changes in color over the years, but still looks pretty cool. Is that something you see happening as your outdoor works go through the decades?
Yeah. It turns so absolutely beautiful when the patina really takes over the sculpture. And the ones that I installed by Lake Emily were patinaed by me prior, but the patina continues to age and get more and more brilliant to a turquoise color. And so that's another reason to work with it, is its beauty.
Can you tell us about the installation at Lake Emily Park? This is near Stevens Point. Can you paint us a picture, first of all?
It's a beautiful, beautiful area. As I went through it, there's dancing grounds that have been there for over 500 years. You can see just everywhere on how natives had lived there, with a very large burial ground with lots and lots of mounds. It was a spiritual experience for me to be there. And so when the people from Lake Emily wanted to honor the natives that lived there for well over 500 years, I would say probably well over 1,000 years, that there was Ray Ricer, Dr. Ray Ricer, was the lead person there, and he was an archaeologist that oversaw all things that happened there. And Karen Ann Hoffman, she's on the Wisconsin Arts Board and also an Oneida Indian. And they, told me of this special spot, and when I went there, I just couldn't believe how beautiful the spot was.
And then your sculpture there is called The Sustainers. Can you tell us a little bit about what it looks like and what it represents?
Well, the Sustainers for the Oneidas are the three sisters. And the three sisters' names are Corn, Beans, and Squash. And the Corn is the big, strong girl. And the Beans crawl up around her. And the Beans, or the Squash, keeps the ground moist and weed-free. And those three are always together. And so it was something I felt was important to, for everybody to know that that's how we typically grow food, with those three together. And I also brought fish into the picture too on that piece. And the fish was designed to be, to show that we also, used fish, and, being Lake Emily, I felt incorporating that was real important.
And before this piece, you worked on an installation in downtown Green Bay called Among the Aspens. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Oh, Among the Aspens was a beautiful thing. When Green Bay had come to me and asked about what I thought community was without talking about humans, and I instantly responded, well, it has to be aspens. And they're going, well, why aspens? And I says, because their inner roots are all connected. They talk to each other. They grow in groups, and the oldest tree in America is an 80,000-year-old aspen tree in Fish Creek, Utah. Aspens never hibernate. They continue to grow all winter long. They lose their leaves, but they continue to grow, in which the animals of the forest can take advantage of having, fresh sap and fresh bark to be able to eat. And so the aspens is true, it's a community tree. It's what represents humans in plant form.
What do you hope people take away from seeing and interacting with these public sculptures you have out in these prominent places?
Well, the ones in Green Bay, I wanted to show the past, the present, and the future of Green Bay. And the Oneida Indians have been living in Green Bay area for well over 200 years and felt that we are a strong part of the community. So I drew in petroglyphs and pictographs that we know of or what they mean, because some of them we don't know what they mean. And so these petroglyphs or pictographs that are on each piece are all highlighted real bright. But they talk about, you know, where Green Bay's going, and Green Bay's going in the right spot. And the same thing with Lake Emily. What really wonderful people that want to make a difference in their communities do this type of thing. You know, they put up a monument to remind us all on how we should be taking care of Wisconsin.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks for the interview. I appreciate it, and I'm glad to let people know a little bit more about Native Americans.
That's Mark Fisher, contemporary sculptor, member of the Oneida Nation of Green Bay. We talked to him today about a couple of his latest art installations, as you heard, in Green Bay and near Stevens Point. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on the mission behind an annual benefit concert.
There's a father in Madison who turned a tragedy into a cause for hope. Mike Gamal lost his son to epilepsy, then founded the organization and benefit concert, Joey's Song. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick tells us, it supports people with epilepsy.
Mike Gamal is not a rock star, but he knows how to get them to rally around a cause.
As you start out an email or a phone call with, "My five-year-old son died and I need your help," most people, they can't always help, but most people will say, "Well, what can I do to help?"
In 2010, his son Joey Gamal died, just 1 week shy of his fifth birthday. He suffered a severe and rare form of epilepsy called Dravet syndrome. Epilepsy is a chronic neurological disease that causes seizures. To Gamal, Joey was a carefree and happy kid.
He made the best of life and was always laughing and always smiling and always, he was in his own world, but he was never had a down moment. And those are the kinds of things that I think about.
Gamal was always a music fan, and so was Joey, especially when he heard a song by Sesame Street's Elmo.
He would grab everybody by their finger and make them get up and dance, and he kind of had this little boppy dance, and his word for dance was D, D.
As a way to work through his grief, Gamal created the nonprofit Joey's Song in honor of his son and their family's positive memories of him. The organization raises money to fund research grants and support programs for people with epilepsy. He started selling CDs, but found that the events Gamal paired them with raised far more money. Gamal said there are plenty of causes to support, and he's learned to not take no from an artist personally. Yet his tenacity has helped Gamal successfully assemble an impressive lineup that would catch the eye of any 90s rock fan. Performers include members of Garbage, Soul Asylum, Belly, and Fountains of Wayne. There's also the Wisconsin musicians supergroup, the Know-It-All Boyfriends. All of the musicians play for free. Letters to Cleo singer Kay Hanley was one of the performers at Joey's Song this year. She says her daughter experienced seizures, but it took a long time to receive a proper diagnosis.
We had a neurologist that treated a certain kind of epilepsy, and then she developed into another kind of epilepsy, and the doctor didn't know how to treat it, and we didn't know where to go.
Finally, they found a pediatric epilepsy specialist at LA Children's Hospital.
She said, "In my estimation, your treatment has been a failure." And we all burst into tears, but like, it wasn't sad tears, it was happy tears, because it was like we finally felt like we were understood.
Hanley says her daughter, who's 23 now, has been treated and is doing well, but she says it's important to continue raising awareness. According to the Epilepsy Foundation, 1 in 26 people will get epilepsy in their lifetime. Data from the CDC shows that in Wisconsin, nearly 60,000 people have the disorder. Find out about the victim. I didn't know. Gamal says he wanted to start a charity dedicated to fighting epilepsy when Joey was alive. But after Joey passed, Gamal tapped into his Madison music scene connections to kickstart the organization.
The prognosis then and even today isn't really great with Dravet's. So we knew that there wasn't a lot we were going to do to make Joe's life better, even if he had survived.
But he knew he could do something to help other families.
For me, it was like, okay, let's try to change something. If we can make one family not go through what we went through our efforts, then it's worth whatever hours that we put into it.
Years later, Gamal says he considers many of the musicians involved in Joey's song his friends.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on Joey's Song, an organization that supports people with epilepsy. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, how has the new 988 Lifeline been helping people here in Wisconsin? We'll find out how it works and what services it provides. That's coming up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Join WPR tomorrow night at 7 for live coverage of the 2023 State of the State address by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. After the governor, hear the Republican response from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. WPR's Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg are your hosts for this special coverage. It's the 2023 State of the State Address, tomorrow night at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Now, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline officially became the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline in mid-July of last year. That meant rather than having to call an 800 number, people seeking help could just call or text 988. According to data from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, that number received 6,000 calls in July alone after it launched in the middle of the month. We're past the six-month mark of the new number being in operation. We wanted to check back on how things have been going for Wisconsin's 988 call center, managed by Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin. Caroline Crehan-Newman is Crisis Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Caroline, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This was a long time in the making, as I understand it. How big a transition was it to go from that the older 800 number to this new three-digit 988 number?
Well, it's a very big deal. I think it's something that was a long time coming. I think, as many of us know, we have a three-digit number, 911. We have several other three-digit numbers, 411, 211, for different needs that we have. And mental health and substance use crisis is certainly something that needs the attention, and 988 is here to support Wisconsinites and people across the nation.
When someone in need calls 988, what can they expect? What do they get?
So when someone calls 988, we like to be really transparent. We have all of this information on our webpage, but when you call, you'll receive a very brief automated response to let you know that you've reached the Lifeline, and there are prompts asking if you are a veteran or if you'd like to speak to a Spanish speaker. And then once you have answered those prompts and have a brief hold, maybe 20 to 30 seconds, you'll be connected with a counselor. If you're calling from Wisconsin, you'll be connected with, like you mentioned earlier, Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin, who are our partners with Wisconsin DHS. And when people call and they're connected with a counselor, usually that counselor just opens up the floor to the person who's calling and asking, what caused you to call 988 today? And you sort of go through that journey of being provided support by a trained counselor.
Are they able then to refer to further services if needed?
Yeah, so our center here in Wisconsin has a really extensive contract with 211 Wisconsin, which provides referral resources all across the state. And so although our 988 Wisconsin Center is located in Green Bay, if you are anywhere throughout the state, if you live in Iowa or Grant County or Bayfield or Kenosha, and you call 988, the counselor on the phone will be able to you know, look into their computer and be able to very quickly provide resources and referrals to you, whether that be mental health related or substance use related, domestic abuse, housing, things like that.
And I understand texting is an option instead of a call or in addition to a call.
Yes, both texting and chat are an option for 988. Chat has been around for a while. It existed before the transition to 988. Texting is newer. What we're seeing in terms of data, chat has maintained similar numbers as it did years prior, but we are seeing an increase in texts. I think the more advertising and the more people learn about 988, texting is a really appealing option, especially for those that are maybe younger and just more comfortable with the anonymity of text and the accessibility.
We're talking to Caroline Crean Newman with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, the Crisis Services Coordinator there. Talk about the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Replaced the older, longer number. It's a three-digit number now. It replaced that system in mid-July of last year. Caroline, funding for this program, the federal government put a lot into it at the outset. Is there a sustainable source of funding to keep these efforts going into the future here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so that's something not only Wisconsin, but basically every other state across the nation is looking at, sustainable funding. There are different avenues to sustainable funding. The federal legislation that created 988, that was passed and signed into law in 2020, did allow states to, or gave states the permission to pass some type of fee or a tax, whether that be a telecom fee or tax, or something else, which is how 911 is funded across most states. So it's something that we're exploring. We are currently working through funds from a federal grant. We've received a couple of grants, and the federal government just awarded us additional money through supplemental funding. So we're looking at long term. We, of course, need and want to make this service sustainable. Yeah, we're working towards that.
And Caroline, I understand part of the incentive for doing this three-digit number system was it would be more accessible, easier for people to reach when they need it. Has that borne out so far in these first 6 months, do you think?
Yeah, we have seen an increase in definitely in calls and definitely in texts. Wisconsin, along with I know some other Midwestern states, are going to be launching their own statewide campaigns. So everyone listening can expect to see maybe commercials, billboards, radio ads for 988 in Wisconsin. Our state-specific tagline is 24/7 call, chat, text. And so we're really hoping to reach more people, to let people know what to expect when they reach out, and that support is there if they need it.
I know different states are offering different services in some cases for different community members. You mentioned, for example, there's a Spanish language option, an option for veterans. Some states have provided special counseling for LGBTQ people who call in. Do you have other tailored programs like that, or are you looking for to provide more in the future?
So the crisis continuum of services can be a little confusing. Mm-hmm. In terms of veterans and Spanish speaking, that's all a part of the national rollout. In terms of Wisconsin, we have a plethora of services that are largely delivered through the county system. And so if someone calls 988 and needs further services, maybe it's appropriate for a mobile team to be dispatched out to where they are in the community. Maybe they're looking for a referral to a therapist. Maybe they're looking for more of a wraparound program. That person may be asked if they're interested in being transferred to a county crisis program. And so we do have a lot of services in place, but we're continuing to look and assess how to make 988 stronger, how to reach more people. And if that means including different or a variation of services in the future, that's something we're definitely open to.
Is 988 a service that might be used by maybe not the person in crisis themselves, but say a family member who is concerned?
Yes, absolutely. We see that quite a bit. So we see sometimes a friend who was talking to one of their peers at school who maybe expressed some suicidal ideation. I don't really want to be here anymore. This is just so hard. We see parents calling children, calling about their parents. We see really a wide array of different people who are calling. And that is perfectly, we encourage that. If you are concerned about someone, please feel free to call. And whether we can get that person on the phone or the counselor can provide support to that person on how to better support their friend, daughter, son, parent, that's all encouraged.
In just our last few moments, Caroline, I know there's labor difficulties in a lot of fields. Are you able to keep up and have enough staff on hand to meet the demand here?
Yeah, so that's something Wisconsin is actively working on, as are many other states. You certainly nailed it. There is a staffing shortage, and it's no surprise that this work is incredibly challenging. And so one of the things that we're working on and we're working on with Family Services is how to unroll or roll out a remote workforce. And so what does it look like to be able to hire staff and counselors throughout the state who are supporting 988, taking calls, chats, and texts remotely while also being supported by supervisors and leadership in the organization? So I think in some ways the pandemic has opened up a remote workforce and will make that possible and easier for us to make 988 a success.
Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Caroline Crean Newman with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services talking about the rollout of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Tomorrow, a look at technology layoffs and opportunities in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to a Wisconsin scientist who's a co-author of a new international report about removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, labor unions saw some gains in 2022, but overall membership rates are down in Wisconsin and across the country. Look into the latest data and trends in organized labor. First, one key to limiting climate change is carbon dioxide removal. That's according to a new international report that finds that removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere will be a key part of hitting international goals aimed at lowering the overall amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. The report sums up the current state of carbon dioxide removal and how much more will be needed. According to the report, we need a big boost in CO2 removal technologies alongside efforts to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. The La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison was involved in the State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report. Our guest is one of the report's authors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Do you think that there should be a bigger focus on this, more public investment in developing and implementing new technologies that help take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Gregory Nemeth is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and a contributor to the State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report. Gregory, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks. It's good to be back.
We talk a lot on this network and elsewhere about cutting carbon dioxide emissions to help stop or at least slow down climate change. Can you talk about the importance of focusing on removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as well?
Yeah, sure. The first thing I'd say is that removing CO2 from the atmosphere is not a substitute for reducing emissions. We need to do both. We need to cut emissions rapidly to avoid the worst damages of climate change that happen once we exceed 1.5 and 2 degrees, and we're already at 1.2. So it's not a substitute. But because we've dithered for 30 years in reducing emissions, we have a bigger challenge on our hands than we would have had if we had started seriously 30 years ago. And so now we do actually have to do some work to remove some of the CO2 that's already there on the order of maybe 10 to 20% of what we do for emissions reductions, we have to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and move it in the other direction.
This report sums up global efforts at carbon dioxide removal. I see a number of 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide taken out of the atmosphere per year, I think it was. But it sounds like a big number, but I gather it's not big enough.
Yeah, everything's big when you're talking about the climate. It's the whole planet we're talking about here. But just to put it in perspective, yeah, we're already doing 2 billion tons of removal, mostly through trees and planting forests and that type of thing that we're all familiar with. We put 40 billion tons into the atmosphere every year. So we've got two going the other direction. So it's helpful. It's a good start. But we need to get up to like 10 billion tons of removal in the next 30 years to make this relevant to the climate.
I see lots of things about these high-tech options for taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. As you just mentioned, though, high technology like trees, and I gather soil management is doing a lot of the job. How important is that? Are we actually adding to the number of trees that's taken out, or are we just like coasting in our current level of forests right now?
Yeah, no, right now, I mean, this, like you said, it's a global report. So for the whole world, we are removing 2 billion tons a year through trees and other land management practices. So that's in the right direction. We probably need to scale that up by a factor of 2, so double it to maybe 4 gigatons. But at some point, we start to have impacts on using land for other things like agriculture. And so we can't do it all with things like trees. So we do need to go to engineered solutions as well. But one of the options that seems especially intriguing is storing carbon in soils, because there you have this co-benefit of higher carbon in soils. In some situations, can actually increase agricultural yields, and the total amount of available capacity to store carbon in soils is gigaton scale. And so that's a pretty promising direction to move as well.
We're talking about a new global report on the state of carbon dioxide removal, looking at efforts to get this key climate change atmospheric substance out of the atmosphere. Gregory Nemet is with us, a co-author of that report, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're curious about the options for getting the CO2 out of the atmosphere once it's already there, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gregory, before we dig into some of the technologies that may be options, you were one of the lead authors on a chapter of the report looking at a global investment in these technologies. What are we seeing?
Yeah, so we're seeing some promising signs. We're seeing lots of patenting in this area. So that's usually a leading indicator of innovation and of technologies to emerge in the future. In particular, we're seeing patenting in what's called direct air capture. So that's basically doing on a large scale what we already do in submarines and spacecraft, where we're removing people's breath that's exhaling CO2. So we know how to do that. But the challenge is to do that at a really large scale when we're taking it out of the atmosphere. So we are seeing some promising signs of innovation. We're also seeing signs of investment in research and development expenditure. We tracked about $4 billion worldwide. To put it in perspective, about $17 billion was spent last year in research and development on clean energy technology. So it's still not as big as that, but it's going in the right direction. The U.S. is playing a pretty big role in that amount. So there are some promising signs, but the scale-up challenge is really gigantic. And so that's the next stage we have to deal with.
Right. If we're talking about boosting our investments in research and development this year, it could take a long time to develop those things, scale them, and then put them into practice at a large scale. Are these things that are going to happen soon enough to make a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly the issue. It's not can we do it, is it can we do it fast enough? And there's urgency here. And we know from previous technologies that it takes a while. It takes a while to go from patent to laboratory to development stage to actually scaling up to something that's big. So in a way, we know from the past that this is not a simple challenge. It's not something we can do overnight. But we also know from the past is that we've done this successfully in other technologies, and some of them that are relevant to the climate, like what we've seen with wind and solar in the last 20 years. A lot of that's been inspiration for us who've been working in that area to say, well, could carbon removal kind of be where renewables were 25 years ago? Interesting, promising, clean, but too tiny to actually do anything for the energy or climate issue. But they grew it like 30% a year. And when you do that over 30 years, you start to become a substantial part of the solution. And so the question is, could carbon removal technologies have that kind of trajectory? Because if they take that trajectory of what solar has done and grow at 30% a year, they don't even need to go as fast as electric vehicles, which have grown even faster than that. But if we do have that type of investment and growth, then we are talking about billions of tons of removal of these novel technologies for carbon dioxide removal. So a lot of what we're doing is comparing it to things that we've done well, and then looking at, well, how did we do those things? What did we do for, say, ammonia synthesis? So making fertilizer a worldwide global commodity from something that was tiny 100 years ago, that took a long time, but it also took lots of investment. And that's a pretty good model from what we might need for carbon removal as well.
There are different technologies out there when it comes to carbon removal, some of them outlined in the report. Is there one that stands out to you as closest to the starting gate, if not already running?
Yeah. So the one that's closest to the starting gate and already running are planting trees. No question about that. And the only issues that come up with planting trees are, one, how durable is that for storing carbon? Like, could you decide to cut down the trees with deforestation, or could you have wildfires that take them away? Or would you start using agricultural land for forest? So we do have concerns, but that's a technology that's proven, and no issues about how does it work and does it work. On the other hand, we have technologies that don't have those same land use issues and substitution issues. For example, doing this submarines technology called direct air capture, which doesn't take much land, and it's a chemical process. And, you know, there the issue is it takes energy to heat up the solvents to remove the CO2, and it takes capital to build all these machines. And so there's different challenges for these different technologies. But one of the reasons we're optimistic, right, in this report is there are a lot of different methods that are likely to work well in different places. Like, for example, in Wisconsin, we could imagine doing more soil carbon sequestration with our agricultural lands. In other places, we could be doing direct air capture. In other places, doing more tree planting. And so there's a variety of solutions, which I think makes me optimistic, because any of them are going to have issues when you do them at really large scale. And you can mitigate some of those issues by having, you know, a bunch of solutions, not just one silver bullet.
I wonder if I'm going to, you know, build a wind turbine, I can hopefully sell that energy, make some money doing it. If I build an electric vehicle, I can sell it to somebody. Is there a market incentive we can have for carbon sequestration? Like, if I catch a bunch of carbon, who's going to pay me to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's probably one of the biggest issues of all, is where is this market going to come from? But somewhat surprisingly, and this is one thing that, you know, I enjoy doing this science and reports when I learn something, and I learned in putting all the data together that we've had $200 million of purchases of removed carbon over the last year. And so, you know, that's substantial numbers. It's, you know, probably going to need to scale up to a couple more orders of magnitude, like by a factor of 100, to make this climate relevant. But that's a start. So there are people, companies, individuals, companies and countries that are actually starting to pay for removing CO2. But ultimately, we need to move beyond these kind of voluntary commitments of removal to policies that create strong incentives and obligations to remove CO2, because once we get to billions of tons a year, someone's going to have to be paying for that. And that's going to be a policy that'll have to drive that.
Talking to Gregory Nemeth, co-author of the first State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We're talking about the role of CO2 removal in the effort to slow down climate change. It's not just cutting emissions, the report says, but getting some of that CO2 out of the atmosphere. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about these newer carbon dioxide removal technologies? Do you want to see the U.S., the federal government, invest more in these newer technologies? Would you like to see more tree planting? Is there a candidate piece of land in your neck of the woods that you think could be a good forest and draw some carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Gregory Nemeth, co-author of a new international report studying carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere. Gregory is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We're looking at the world's current capacity, advancing technologies, future demand for taking CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere in the effort to limit global warming. and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the cost, the impact, the technologies when it comes to carbon dioxide removal? Do you want to see more research, development, public investment in carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Doug is with us in Portage. Doug, hi.
Hi. I'm addressing the question that you just asked the guest about what's the incentives for someone to remove carbon dioxide from the air. And now I know, and to me the answer is biochar. If you take organic waste, leaves, grass, twigs, branches, bark, that things that removed carbon dioxide from the air within the last few years, and you pyrolyze it, some of the carbon gets put back into the air, but not all. About a third of it ends up creating charcoal. If you then put that charcoal into compost, you can sell that at a premium. People pay big bucks for biochar compost.
And are you doing this yourself, Doug?
I am. Yes, I am, for my own good. I'm not selling it. I haven't. My goal is to make a backyard biochar that will emit no smoke, no odors, meet the 2.5 EPA regs for particulates, be able to run it on a host of different materials, not have to spend tons of time trying to get it perfect, to then be able to use the excess heat to do two things. One, I'm going to get granite dust from monument makers, grave stone makers. Uh-huh. They have no source for it. At the elevated moist temperature of the flue gas from burning wood, making biochar, it's not burning, pyrolyzing wood to make biochar and burning the syngas,
uh-huh,
that granite dust will react, should react quite rapidly with the carbon dioxide in the air, creating carbonates.
Wow.
And removing the carbon dioxide.
Doug, thanks a lot for sharing that backyard project. And that's in Doug's backyard, Gregory, but I understand biochar is on the menu of carbon dioxide capture technologies.
Yeah, great to hear from Doug. Certainly, biochar is one of the important arrows in our quiver. We assessed that we could do more than 1 billion tons a year from biochar. And as Doug suggests, it's interesting because there are what we call in innovation studies, niche markets. So there are places where people are willing to pay for biochar, and it's as an agricultural amendment, as you said, and the prices are actually quite high now. And we don't think that you can do 1 billion tons of biochar by selling it to people that are interested in, you know, flower beds in cities and things where you can have higher yields. Like that's one place that's used and is highly valued. So you can't do 1 billion tons on that, but you can get started. And as Doug says, we're already getting started, and he's doing it for his own interest and maybe his own garden. Like he says, there's prices paid for biochar. So that's a great way to get started. And it has this benefit of creating higher agricultural yields while also storing carbon in the soils in the form of biochar, which is, you can kind of think of it as similar to charcoal that we make from wood. So yeah, certainly biochar is an interesting area and one that could move quickly because it's got these niche markets where you don't need a policy to get started. You can do what Doug's doing.
Doug, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. We heard from Barry in Janesville, who also mentions markets like welding gases and medical gases needing the carbon removed from the atmosphere. Interesting. Back to your calls now. Kelly is with us calling from Minnesota. Kelly, hi.
Greetings. I would just like to remind your guest, who probably does not need reminding, but your listeners, that trees are not the only means of sequestering or direct air capture of carbon. Grass, although it's been forgotten by our federal ag policy for 75 years, has been direct capturing carbon for eons and can do so really more effectively than any Swiss or British Columbia direct air capture.
Interesting. Kelly, thanks a lot for sharing this with us. Grasslands, Gregory, are they part of the toolkit here?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, there's scientists at UW-Madison that are working on that, and it's a lot about trying to appreciate what native plants and native grasses do so well, which is have super highly developed roots, which store a lot of carbon and material there and in the soils around them. So, yeah, grasses seems like something that's particularly interesting in our upper Midwest geography.
Kelly, thanks for that call. Jackie joins us now in Milwaukee. Jackie, hello.
Hi. I've got a place up north that can take some more trees. Are some tree species better than others?
Oh, interesting, Gregory. Do we have research saying if you're looking to capture carbon, plant tree X instead of tree Y?
Yeah, there are. I think the ones that have been worked on a fair amount in UW here are poplar trees because they grow fast. And so if you're growing fast, then you're storing a lot of carbon in the trunks of the trees. So yeah, that's certainly an interesting area. You know, one thing that we'll have to work out is if we try to optimize how much carbon we store in trees and one particular species, whichever one turns out to work most efficiently in a particular geography works out, we may still want to have some diversity in the forest because we want to have biodiversity. We want to have healthy forests. And those depend not on monocultures, but on many different types of trees. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about. If you're going to plant a few trees, what's the optimal one for storing CO2 and storing carbon in the trees? But on a larger scale, we have to think about diversity too, because biodiversity is something that's also an objective and that does better when we have a variety of types of plants and trees.
Thanks a lot for that call. Gregory, I want to touch on a couple other technologies that came up on the list. Here's one I don't really understand. Enhanced rock weathering.
Yeah, so that's something that, you know, some of these are nature directly observed, like planting trees, and some of them are nature inspired by looking at how rocks can actually react with CO2 that's in the atmosphere. It happens really slowly over time. We call it weathering. And one thing we could potentially do is do that on a much faster scale. And that's called enhanced weathering, where we react CO2 in the atmosphere with rocks. And the key there is just make a lot more surface area, because that's how you get reactions to happen. And so the key to making a lot of surface area with rocks is grinding them up into very fine particles. And that's something we know how to do in the mining industry. And so we would have to take, you know, minerals and grind them up into small particulates and then scatter them on agricultural fields or on coastlines. They'd become part of the ocean. And those are permanent removals because they stay, the CO2 would stay as carbon in the rocks that it reacts with. So there, it's not very, it's not rocket science. It's mining, but doing it on a large, really large scale. And anytime you do things on a really large industrial scale like that, there'll be issues. So again, it's another arrow in our quiver, but not something we would want to bank everything on because, you know, there's dust and particulates that come from crushing rocks that we would need to do there. So we'd have to be careful about how that works as well. None of these solutions are perfect and without their issues, but that's one that's appealing and attractive and in certain geographies could work really well.
And Gregory, you co-wrote this first of its kind report on carbon dioxide removal. Is this going to be a regular thing that you do now?
Yeah, we'd like it to be. You know, I think part of the reason is we could only do so much in the 100 or so pages that we had. And as we've talked about it to people and had people ask questions about it, we realize there's other things that we need to focus more on. So for example, we're going to be doing more on looking into particular geographies. So this first report really wanted to scope everything comprehensively and globally, but it's going to be much more interesting on what's the potential, say, for biochar in the U.S. or in the upper Midwest or in Wisconsin. So downscaling some of the analysis is one direction we go. Looking into some of the impacts, both positive and negative, of deploying these is something we've only sketched out that's going to be important as we go further. So that'll be something we'll look at as well. And then bringing in a broader set of perspectives than we had on this first round, I think will help, you know, elucidate some of the justice or distributional issues that might come with deploying some of these technologies that at the really large scale we'll need for them to be relevant for the climate.
And we'll leave it there. Gregory, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
That's Gregory Nemeth at UW-Madison's La Follette School, co-author of The State of Carbon Dioxide Removal Report. Coming up, a look at labor unions after some high-profile strikes and efforts in 2022. This is Central Time.